This is an interview with Florrie Evans about mudlarking. It was recorded by Marley Collins on the 22nd of March 2024 for the Making More Mischief Oral History Project.
That looks good.
Okay.
It's Friday the 22nd of March 2024. We're in Florrie's flat in Bethnal Green, her home in Bethnal Green, for the Making More Mischief exhibition, and my name's Marley Collins. Florrie, could you tell us your name and can you introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
Yes, my name's Florrie Evans and I am a committed lifetime mudlark, obsessive, but also I'm an art dealer by profession and art historian. So I think that mudlarking and history and art all kind of work together really nicely.
All right. What started you mudlarking? What's your background? What made you interested in mudlarking and the Thames?
Well, I have to kind of go back to my childhood. I was very fortunate. I grew up near the river in southwest London, and my mum, being Australian and having herself grown up in Sydney on the water, always insisted that she needed to be near water wherever she lived. So that's why I grew up by the Thames. And so really at low tide, the Thames was my playground and my brother's. So we used to go down a lot. And the first thing I remember collecting was blue and white pottery shards, because to me it was obvious treasure. The first thing you kind of spot out of the flinty brown mud is colour. And it kind of went from there. So I was always picking that up. And then a little bit later on, I discovered clay pipes on a school trip to Hampton Court Palace. And I was like, oh, I've seen these by the river, and not known what they were. And it kind of grew from there. But I associate the river very much with my childhood and with my mum, actually, who, you know, she liked us to be outdoors and to be out and about a lot.
Do you always keep yourself to the Thames?
I don't, have you ever
done any other rivers? And is it still called mudlarking on other rivers?
It is, I guess. In other rivers, it depends on whether you're wading or if you're in a tidal river. I have been wading in Hampshire with my friend Mike, who is a keen wader, I think he would call himself. But I've also been bottle digging in Victorian and Edwardian dump sites on the outskirts of London. I mean, I'm just a bit obsessed now. But this really has grown as an obsession in the last sort of 10 years, 15 years, really. There was a period in my adult life when I stopped going mudlarking. In my 20s, I couldn't be asked, you know, I was too busy having fun, going out and building my career. So it was like there was a hiatus from childhood when I was doing it a lot to early adulthood where I stopped, and maybe I thought it was a bit embarrassing as well. And then in my 30s, I moved to this part of London and met my now boyfriend and father of our child, and on our first date we went to a great gallery near the water in Wapping called the Wapping Project. Sadly it's no longer there, but it was in an old warehouse, and we kind of went and saw an exhibition. I can't even remember what it was of, something contemporary, something conceptual, and it had a nice cafe in the space. And after we'd had a cup of tea, he was like, why don't we go down by the river? And I was like, brilliant. So we went and found a way down, and it was low tide. And then I started telling him about how I had mudlarked a lot as a child. And back then, this is about 15 years ago, mudlarking wasn't as well known as a pastime. And, you know, he'd never heard of it. And I think a lot of people hadn't heard of it. And I explained to him what it was, and I was picking bits up as we were walking along. And then I realised that, why had I stopped? And the obsession grew again, and it was rekindled with my romance. And then I had my daughter eventually in 2014, and I found on my maternity leave that, you know, she was quite a crying-ish, screamy baby. Not, you know, no offence to her, but she was quite difficult to settle and get to sleep. So I found going for long walks by the river with her in a sling was very therapeutic for me. And, you know, I would kind of mudlark with her on me. And yeah, that's how I filled my maternity leave. And then I went back to work and I was like, well, I'm not stopping. And that was that.
Wow. Does she go with you?
She does. She does. She doesn't go with me all the time. I mean, the tide has to coincide with her very busy schedule. You know, obviously she's at school during the week. On Saturdays she learns the trumpet and she has music school, and so, you know, it has to be the right tide time, and if we go it's usually a Sunday. But, you know, I work from home, I'm self-employed now, so if I can go during the week by myself, I will. You know, it's me time, refueling batteries time. And yeah, so I do go with her, and she's a great companion, and she's quite small, so she's low to the ground and she spots things. But sometimes I think she has the gift of seeing things, but not necessarily is that she's not that bothered. You know, I might go nuts over something that she picks up and she's like, oh, whatever.
And has that come with time, do you think? Do you see yourself as that child?
She's not very acquisitive. She really isn't acquisitive in the way that I was. I have always been a total magpie. I like stuff. And she really isn't someone who has that desire to acquire, which I really admire, actually. She's a different personality. But she's good at mudlarking, so she's my secret weapon.
Now I'm just going to pause this for a moment because I'm not happy with the levels, and then I'll start again.
Yeah.
Florrie Evans, part two.
Okay, so we're back on, and hopefully we've got a better sound. So can you tell me, what is there any training to mudlarking, and what's your typical day like when you decide to go?
Well, I don't think any training is necessary, just a desire to find something. But you do learn how to read the foreshore, definitely, and you can get better at it the more you do it. So you learn how the river deposits things by weight, and you can learn to read the tide lines, as they're called. So you get what I call bone lines higher up on the foreshore. Lighter things wash up near the top. And then you get metal deposits. So where you have lots of rusty nails, you will find perhaps a coin or a button. So you learn where to look, definitely. But training isn't necessary. I mean, you know, you just have to want to find something and to get down on your knees and stop and pause and ponder a particular patch and then move on. And there are people who mudlark with different styles. You get kind of rangy mudlarks, people who like to stride along and treat it as a walk where you spot things. And they might be the pottery pickers, people who pick up lovely bits of pottery which are easy to spot. And then you get people who literally will choose one patch of foreshore that they know is generous and full of interesting artifacts, and they might stay in the same 5 meters squared for the whole time that they're there, which might be an hour, might be 2 hours.
What's your style?
I'm somewhere between the two, because I do get impatient, and I do get FOMO. I worry if I'm on one patch that I'm missing out on another patch.
What do you mean by FOMO?
Fear of missing out. Fear of missing out on the treasure. So if I...
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah, I know. So I will, you know, choose a patch, get down on my knees, have a look. If it seems productive, I'll stay there a little bit. Then I might get twitchy that I'm missing out further along, so I'll walk a bit. and I might suddenly have it in my head that I need to get to X spot, so I'll just walk quite fast and get there, and then I'll stop again. So I'm kind of stop and start, stop and start.
Can you try and take me through a day where you're deciding to go mudlarking, like from when you leave the house to when you get down there, how it feels, what you do, your process, and then coming home?
Sure.
Could you do that, just so we understand what's going on in your head and how you feel?
Right, well, I try and ad-lib when I go mudlarking, because I really am not someone who plans. I'm very bad at planning. I have always been bad at planning. So you'll get mudlarks who have all the kit, wear all the kit, have the tide times on their phone, and will, you know, plan to a T how they're going to spend their time. That's not me. I'll wake up one morning and think, oh, I'm on top of my workload. I wonder what time low tide is today. I'll then have a Google, find out what time low tide is, and I'll think, oh, can I fit it in? And say there might be a low tide at 12:30. I'll go, brilliant. Right, I will try and give myself a couple of hours. So around 10 o'clock, I'll hop on my bike, and maybe if I'm feeling organised, I might have put my wellies in a pannier, or I'll even have put them on my feet. Depends on how organised I'm feeling, or I might just be in my trainers and think, well, who cares, I'll just go as I am. And I go down to my local patch of foreshore. It's like a 10-minute bike ride. Lock up my bike, go down, start looking, and I'll give myself, you know, a good hour, 2 hours, ideally 2 hours, but sometimes it might even just be half an hour. It really depends on the tide time. I'm just thinking in an optimal moment, say I was able to give myself 2 hours, that would be the dream. But sometimes it is literally just half an hour. And so, yeah, I'll go down and I don't have a trowel, I don't have any kit. I will pick up an implement on the foreshore, like a long rusty nail, and I'll use that to poke around. But I'm very fortunate, I should add, because in theory, with my license, because I'm in the Society of Mudlarks, of which there are only 52 members at any one time, I can dig to, I think, around 2 meters should I choose, but I have never chosen to do that. But at some point I would like to dig a hole, but I haven't quite plucked up the courage to do so. But it is a great privilege that I am able to dig where other mudlarks aren't, so I'm very aware that I'm lucky in that respect.
Could you tell me more about that license and how that's come about, and just briefly, because that's so interesting to me. So there's some people that can go and can't do that, and some
yeah,
can.
Well, there's the standard license that's issued by the Port of London Authority. Licenses only became obligatory in 2017. So I didn't even have a license until then, when it became, you know, I think around then, mudlarking was starting to become more popular through social media. And so the PLA saw that, you know, it was important to keep an eye on what was happening down there and ensure that people were recording their finds. So they made a license obligatory. So that was the first time I got a license. At which point an elderly mudlark said to me, oh, well, you ought to be in the society. And I was like, what's that? And he said, well, you know, in the 1970s, they were going to stop mudlarking altogether, and we did a sit-in on the foreshore and, you know, showed that we'd found amazing artefacts and given them to Museum of London, and that we were a very necessary group of people. And they were granted a special license to continue their mudlarking and to continue digging trenches and finding artefacts, and on the understanding that they would record and gift a lot of their finds to the museum, which they do. And he said, well, you know, there are only ever 52 members, so it might take a while, but put your name down on the waiting list. So I did. And
how long was the waiting list?
Well, it's kind of dead man's shoes. Dead men's shoes. But I just got, so it was this year that I finally got into the society. Thank you very much. Thank you. But I think the waiting list has got really long now because obviously there are so many more mudlarks and so many more people who are interested in obviously joining the society. So I was lucky that I got on the list around then.
Did you feel fortunate to be on the list? Was it like a Yahoo moment?
Yeah, when I was allowed in, I was thrilled. I also felt like it was a really important moment because myself and two other female mudlocks were initiated at the same time, and there were only two women in the society at that point, and now there's five of us. So, you know, that was great.
Tell me more about the club.
It's a very exclusive club. Yeah, so there are meetings every 3 months, and the fines liaison officer from Museum of London comes and records fines and kind of cherry picks things for the museum. And we discuss foreshore politics. There's a lot of foreshore politics going on, and the PLA and that sort of thing. And at the last meeting, actually, it was another watershed moment. I took my daughter along, my 10-year-old daughter. Although, actually, she ended up sitting with another friend who happened to be in the pub and playing Minecraft on his phone with him. And she didn't really join in the meeting. But, you know, the chair of the society said to me, "Oh, that's a first, having a baby in the club." I was like, well, she's not really a baby, but yeah, okay.
And so, which pub do you mean?
I'm afraid I can't reveal. I'm sorry.
Wow, I bet reveal. It's near the Thames somewhere.
Yes, that's a good guess.
Yeah. Oh, how interesting. Mm. Is it nice to meet with other people at all? Or is it very competitive? Is there a pressure on you?
I don't feel a pressure from other mudlarks at all. I feel a pressure from myself sometimes to find things, and then I have to switch that voice off and go, why am I doing this? I'm not doing it to kind of be the best or find the best artifact. I'm doing it actually for my mental health, because going down to the river for me is headspace. So I have to kind of manage my internal golem. Because, you know, I do love the idea of finding the best treasure. Of course I do. But actually, the treasure is really being by the river and having time and space and self-care. But no, I don't feel pressure from being in the society or, you know, a need to produce the goods. No, I don't.
What's that term? Gollum?
Oh, like in Lord of the Rings, you know, Gollum. Oh, my precious. You know, the ring that becomes a negative influence on the soul of the wearer.
Oh.
You know, there's a little bit of that goes on in mudlarking.
Is there?
Oh, yes.
Ooh. Tell me more. What do you mean?
Well, I think, for instance, that one can become obsessed with finding that jewel, or protective and a bit territorial of a certain area of the river. And, you know, I find that I'm protective of my local area of river, you know, not in the way in which I treat it, you know, but I like the fact that where I go, there aren't so many people, whereas in the centre of town, there are lots and lots of people mudlarking. There's a greater preponderance of fantastic finds in the centre of town because obviously it was the most densely populated part of London historically, so there's going to be more rubbish traditionally dumped there, so there's more to find. But, you know, I like to protect the notion of peace and quiet where I mudlark, so I kind of, it's a a double-edged thing, because I like to share my finds online and say, look what I found, and kind of learn from other mudlarks and the wonderful, generous mudlarking community online, and people who will say, oh, that might be, you know, from the 17th century in a particular type of find. You know, there's a lot of wonderful information and expertise which I learn from, but at the same time I'm a little bit protective of where I go and where I found it, and I wouldn't ever reveal.
So it's quite secretive in a way for
you. Yes, yeah. And that, so I'm Gollum about the river and less Gollum about my finds. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like my precious patch. Oh,
so, tell me more about how you feel, you know, when you drop down, and I'm saying drop down, you do drop down onto the river, do you?
Well, yeah, whether it's down a ladder or down some steps.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, how does that feel when you say that you find this solace? And
yeah.
Sometimes you're in the middle of London and you're on a quite a busy river as well.
Yeah.
So can you tell me more about that, how it feels, and, you know, describing why you do it?
Well, there's that wonderful feeling of expectation and thrill of not knowing what you're going to find. And it also feels like entering a kind of time warp, or what I imagine it might feel like going into a TARDIS. You know, you're there, and ideally it's just you and the river and the birds and maybe the odd kind of siren or street noise, but that just becomes part of the soundscape of the river, and all thoughts kind of leave my head. I sometimes find myself just singing under my breath as I mudlark total random gobbledygook songs. You know, that it's totally like a return to, well, not even a return, but a kind of state of stasis where you're just being, and you're being yourself while connecting with the past. It's a really special feeling.
Yeah, it sounds amazing. It really does. I can really, yeah, link with that, with some of the stuff that I do. Yeah, it's lovely. How do you spot stuff? How do you spot anything? Can you go through that and think what excites you, really?
Yeah. Well, sometimes I don't spot stuff at all, but what I'm good at is choosing where to look. So as I said, you learn to read where might be a productive patch, you know, how the mud is eroding, what type of mud, what kind of things are coming out. So you will sort of look at the foreshore. I will look and go, I think over there, and then I'll go there. And I'll squat down and I will then try and focus and take in a small patch at a time. And then things kind of pop out at me. And I get particularly excited finding articles that relate to historical costume. For a long time, I worked in a gallery that specialised in historical portraits, and I realised I was finding things that I was seeing in the paintings, whether it's a Tudor dangly lace shape on the end of a string on a doublet, you know, or something like that, or buttons, the different types of buttons that you see in historical costume. And so it was wonderful to actually find the physical objects that I was seeing in paintings that were hundreds of years old. So for me, I also love fashion, I love clothes. So those are my favourite things to find. And luckily, you know, buttons pop off clothes. They do. And there is a kind of a good quota of that kind of thing to be found still in the Thames. People often say to me, why are there so many pins and buttons and things in the river? Well, traditionally, the streets of London were swept. And at the end of the day, the street sweepings were thrown into the river. So it wasn't just people chucking their rubbish in the river, it was the street sweepings. And the street sweepings would contain things like the dropped coins, the popped off buttons, the lost pins, all those little tiny objects. And I think that's why they're still there to be found today. And And obviously, sometimes, you know, you've got layers and layers of mud, so it's layers and layers of history, and you'll have something that's lain there undisturbed under mud for centuries, and then it just has gradually eroded away, and you happen to be there at the moment that that little button is showing its face for the first time in 300 years or whatever it may be.
Do you ever get there and you think, wow, straight away you've seen something, and you get very excited? Have you got a favourite find?
I don't have a favourite find. I have favourite collections. So my button collection, my bead collection. But I do also love things that are made from glass. So I love my tiny bottles. When I was little, I collected miniature perfume bottles. So now I collect little bottles that I find, whether they're perfume or apothecary. And two of my favourite things are miniature 17th century glass apothecary bottles, and they're beautiful. They're tiny little globular bottles that fit in the palm of your hand, and you think, oh my god, what quack cure has been in that, and how amazing that this fragile glass object is intact and complete.
You really interest me when you say about the buttons that you saw in paintings. What happens once you've found something? How do you research that? What happens when you come home? How do you research it? And how do you put it into its place, if you like, in history?
Well, I mean, I have to say, it's with mudlarking, you accumulate knowledge. And also, in my research on pictures and paintings, I've learned a lot. So now I can usually ID what I find almost immediately. I know when I pick up a button what period it is. I don't really have to do any research, I just know, because it's knowledge that I've acquired over the years. However, what you can do, which is great fun if you have the time — I'm afraid I don't really have the time — but when you have a button with a maker's name on, for instance, you can go down a whole rabbit hole on the internet trying to identify the tailor. You know, records of his business, and you know, you can find all sorts of fascinating things. I'm afraid I don't really do that. I don't have the time. Maybe I'm too lazy. I don't have the inclination. But you know, as long as I know how to categorize a find and what it is, I'm happy, I'm content. You know, and I put them in the drawer with similar things, and I can pull out the drawer and look at it and fondle them, and you know, that gives me the satisfaction, really. The physical caressing of the object. Yes, it's very physical.
Yeah. Very sensuous, yeah. You talk about your collections and collecting things. Yeah. Is there any certain way you display it or keep it, or and how often do you touch it and look at it again? It's your story. Yeah. And I don't know that all mudlarkers feel the same, but it really
everyone's
strongly
different.
For you.
Yeah.
Can you explain that, what you do afterwards and how you relate to that object or objects,
yeah,
and how you display them, or whatever you think about doing with them? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I get home with my finds and I immediately wash them, because I like everything to be clean and kind of to present as beautifully as possible. So I'm not someone who will get home and pop my finds bag somewhere and forget about it. I want to immediately get everything looking nice and sparkly. and then I put things into my cabinet, my Wunderkammer, which is a 1920s haberdashery cabinet with glass fronted drawers, which my brother and his girlfriend very generously gave to me.
It's
the corner.
Beautiful.
There. Thank you.
Just to say, it's in Florrie's living room. It's absolutely stunning.
And so I keep things in there, and it's vaguely categorized by type of find, and I'm often to be found just staring into my drawers. And sometimes...
Well, there's a saying.
Yeah. When I can't go out mudlarking and I'm feeling stressed and I'm procrastinating and I want to get on top of myself emotionally, I might recategorise a drawer and then I feel in control again and I can get on with my day. And it might look to my boyfriend like I'm wasting time and procrastinating, but actually I'm getting my head in order, but it's giving me mindful time and it's giving me a moment of peace. And, you know, if I can arrange all my buttons by date order and swap around the little boxes, which box I'm going to have things in within the drawers, it makes me feel calm. And it just gives me the fuel to get on with my day.
It's very interesting that you're calm on the river.
Yeah.
Doing it, and you're also calm, you know, looking at your collection and,
yeah,
and organising it.
Yeah.
It's quite an effect.
It definitely is. And I think that, you know, it's just my personality. I'm quite an introverted person. I don't need to get my energy from other people. I mean, I love spending time with friends and family. I do, but I find it exhausting. I find it emotionally exhausting. I find work emotionally exhausting. And it's just my time to be with me and my little treasures. I've always been like that. Since I was tiny, I had my dad's old school tuck box, which I called my treasure chest. And I used to collect little random things that, you know, whether it was a pebble I picked up in the park, it was my treasure, or feathers. I loved collecting feathers. I'd all put them into my treasure chest, and regularly I would be found sorting out my treasure chest when I was little. It's just the same now. It's just, it gives me real peace.
And do you ever make anything or display them in a certain way? Or you're just keeping them?
No, I don't. I know, it's really awful. I wish
I did. It's very individual.
I get lots of people saying, oh, don't you want to make a mosaic with your shards, your ceramic things? And I think, no, they're perfect as they are. I'm a bit purist. I just want to have things arranged by type, by date, at almost like a mini museum.
Yeah. No, I get that. Completely get that from you. I just want to take you into the pearly buttons.
Yes.
Because there is going to be pearly costumes at the exhibition.
Yes.
And I'd love to know if you found any pearly buttons.
I have, and I've lent my pearly buttons to the exhibition. And also that's my pleasure. And also offcuts of mother of pearl from the button making industry. So it's quite interesting. In central London and further east, there are a lot of remnants from the pearly button making industry. And I think that this industry really needs to be looked at as lots of little family businesses. And, you know, it didn't take much to buy, say, a bucket full of Chinese oyster shells, which are more mother of pearly than native oyster shells. So they would be brought in by the ships for trade, and you could buy yourself a bucket full. And then all you needed was skill and a knife to sit and make buttons and sell them. And I think that it probably was an industry dominated by women. I think women and children probably at home made buttons and sold them to tailors. It was very much a cottage industry. And so I think that's why, you know, there aren't necessarily records of the different sort of button making factories, because they didn't exist. They were family businesses, and they would, you know, and you get not just tailors selling buttons, but you had street sellers who would go around with haberdashery things to sell to women in the street. And you can imagine that their suppliers would be, you know, different families as well. It was a very different way of buying and selling in centuries gone by. It's not really how we imagine industry to be today. I mean, obviously in the Victorian era you have industrialization, and things did change forever, but there was still a kind of cottage industry going on by the river, I believe.
Yeah. And you said that the remnants.
Yeah, so you find, I mean literally bits of Chinese oyster shell. You can see in that drawer there, and abalone as well. Can you see the mother of pearl shining out?
Yeah, I can see the shininess, yeah.
Yeah.
So you can actually think that somebody made something like that, and that's the leftover.
Yes, and you also get bone as well, which was worked into button bases, and you find bits of bone with button-shaped holes in. And I've always thought it's odd that I've not found a bit of abalone or Chinese oyster shell with a circular button size hole in it. But then of course shell is much softer and it wears down over time. And actually this is the problem also with mother of pearl buttons found through mudlarking. Often they're quite chalky and crumbly and the shell has started to kind of disintegrate. It's not hard wearing mother of pearl. It's actually quite fragile.
Yeah. I'm really interested as well in your parents. You talking about being on the south of the river and the fact that your mother's Australian.
Yeah.
Is your father Australian as well?
No.
Tell me more about them and your influence. Oh. Because did they take a great interest in your finds on the river, and do they?
Oh, they were always hugely supportive. Well, my dad is a Londoner. He's also from southwest London. He grew up in London near Richmond. And he describes to me how the Thames used to be really filthy in the 1960s. And, you know, he describes the pea soup smog around London even then. And I think it must have looked very different. My dad definitely has encouraged me in subtle ways. So we're quite similar. When I was little, one of the things I loved doing with my dad was skip diving. Oh. So it makes us sound like real wombles, doesn't it? So my dad is an amazing carpenter. He's not a carpenter by profession. He's actually a publisher, well, a retired publisher now. But he always says his most useful qualification and one of his only qualifications from school, because he wasn't particularly academic, was O-level woodwork. So in our house growing up, my dad always was making things. He built a spiral staircase from scratch up to our attic and did a loft conversion all by himself. And he was always looking for wood in skips. And, you know, we moved into a house which had rotten floorboards, but no way did he want to put a carpet down. He wanted to replace the floorboards. It was a Victorian house. So he went round skips looking for Victorian floorboards and for doors and things like that. So I used to get in the car with him and we'd drive around the local area, which was being gentrified really in the 1980s, but a lot of people were stripping things out of houses and chucking them away, and they didn't necessarily have the same respect for period features. But my dad really loved period features, so we were pulling out ceiling roses, you know, door furniture, handles, knobs, that kind of thing. But it was an amazing time for house clearance then. So
This is
1980s, and even in the 90s.
And so how old were you?
I was born in 1980.
Yeah.
So I was a little kid, through to teenage years. We would go skip diving to find things for the house, but you know, he would bring things back for me, like doll heads, bisque doll heads from the Victorian era that he'd find in a skip, or you know, I found an ink bottle, and he also brought home once a miniature roses cordial bottle from the 1920s, which was embossed with leaves and flowers, and I loved it. It went in my miniature bottle collection. So I have very fond memories of doing that with my dad, and my dad doing that for me. So like bringing things back for me, you know, I'd get back from school and he'd be like, oh, I found something really great in the skip today. you know. So that, I think, is a mudlarking spirit that my dad has, but it's focused in a slightly different direction. But, you know, but my mum would just like going for long walks by the river, and, you know, she knew that I was enjoying picking things up, and she'd point things out, like she would say, oh, look, there's a clay pipe over there, or, you know, that sort of thing.
It's fascinating that that came through from your dad.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
The other thing that strikes me is you must have seen the river over quite a long period of time.
Yes.
And listening to your dad, has it changed? How do you... You must notice so much being down there.
Yes, yes.
And what you notice down there and what you notice in the changes. And
oh, definitely. So in the 80s, in southwest London, sort of around Barnes, Mort Lake, that sort of area where I grew up, and Putney, there was a lot of what my mum called flotsam and jetsam, by which I mean plastic rubbish. At low tide, there were certain areas where there was so much rubbish. Honestly, the river was much filthier then than it is now, although it's getting worse again. And I think we're getting back to the point where you can reach a patch of foreshore and be horrified by the number of plastic bottles and plastic wrappers. And it reminds me of the 80s in that respect. We're going downhill, I have to say. And, you know, there was a golden moment in the early noughties, probably when the river was at its cleanest, and it's not as good anymore, and you get a lot of sewage in the river now. I think, you know, 10 years ago it was a lot cleaner than it is now. I see a lot more rubbish now, which is on a scale with the sort of levels of rubbish I saw as a small child. And I don't know what that is. I don't know whether that's just, you know, we're more populated and so there's more rubbish, or people don't care, or companies are throwing... I don't know why it's getting worse, but it is. I think sewage companies are a lot to blame, and people who flush wet wipes and tampon applicators down toilets and things, they're finding their way into the river. And near where my parents live, I think it's called Wet Wipe Island. Near there, there's like a whole area where it's just thick with wet wipes in the foreshore. It's really disgusting.
Does that have an effect on mudlarking, what you're talking about? Well, does it affect you, and does it affect what you find?
Well, it seems to be the suburbs where it's worse. Centrally, it's not as bad. And where I live, there is an area which has a surprising amount of plastic, but, you know, you can still... It doesn't affect how I find things, but it does affect what I bring home. I do always try and bring home a bag of rubbish. I can't pick up all the plastic I see. I can't pick up every vape, but I tend to think... I try and treat it like karma, so I'll pick up something that looks like it's going to harm a bird, like a rubber band or a plastic wrapper that's particularly nasty, and then I think, well, maybe the river will give me something nice in return. I don't know.
And does the erosion help you? Do you like the fact that it erodes, and that is that helping you with your finds?
It definitely is.
And does river traffic have any...
Oh, yes. So on a Sunday...
On
a Sunday it's much sludgier, because the Thames clippers don't run on a Sunday as frequently, if at all. So you get more mud on a Sunday. It's not as good for mudlarking, whereas... The rest of the week, the wake from the waves, from the boats, keeps the foreshore nice and clear, and you can see things, and it erodes faster. So definitely it has a bearing on what one can find and how one looks.
Are the treasures becoming more easily revealed?
Yeah, I suppose you could say it's a golden age for mudlarking with the Thames clippers, because they have such a strong eroding tidal force. They, you know, their waves are so strong. But in terms of the foreshore, it's not very good for the structure of the riverbanks. It's not good, but for mudlarks it is. So it's a kind of double-edged thing.
It must be quite dangerous getting up and down sometimes, is it? Are you just very careful?
I don't really feel like it's dangerous, but I suppose it is. Anything is when you think about it. But yeah, as long as you're aware of tide times, it's fine. It's really fine.
You've not had any near misses?
No.
Oh, good.
No.
That's good to hear. I wanted to ask, sort of, as we're closing up, what's been its impact on you? Mudlarking, finding mudlarking, and then doing it throughout the, you know, your life.
It's been really important, as I say. For me, it's a really center. I don't know how to describe it. I feel like it's an elemental part of my life, and I couldn't not do it. It's essential. And when people say, oh, it's a hobby, I don't think that describes it. It's not a hobby, it's a passion. It's not just a little thing I do on the side, it's part of me.
Do you think it's taken you in any certain direction in your life because of mudlarking?
I think it's given me a fascination for history, and I think it definitely has helped me in terms of what I do with my career and my choices, my life choices, definitely.
Yeah, do you have to be near the Thames?
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like a huge draw.
I would never move away from London.
Wow.
I'm a Londoner.
That's so interesting. How did your mum think about it? Do you consider it a folk tradition?
Yes, I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. I think that people have done it for centuries. Mudlarking is often described as a Victorian phenomenon, with children, destitute children, searching for lumps of coal and bits of rope, old rope for money. You know, that's comes from that. But actually, people have done it out of desperation, out of a desire to look for history as well, for centuries. Of course, it's a very human instinct, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been absolutely fascinating, Flory. Thank you. This is going to be archived. Is there anything else? This is your story.
Thank you.
And is there anything else you'd like to add or say that will be kept on record?
Oh, you've put me on the spot. I can't think of anything. I think your questions have been wonderful and leading, and thank you.
Well, it's been fascinating. It's been very personal. I've not asked you much about your finds, actually. Is there anything special you wanted to add about any of your finds that are particularly dear to you or special? I know you've spoken about buttons and your lovely bottles, which I'd love to see.
I will show them to you, of course.
Maybe I could have a photo with the pair of us and one of your bottles.
Yeah, absolutely.
But is there anything else that you'd like to mention about any of your finds that have taken you in a certain direction or that's special to you in any way, that stand out?
I suppose my most precious finds are things that I found as a child with my mum. But they're not very special.
But they're special to you.
But they're special to me. So my first complete clay pipe bowl, I remember when my mum and I found that, and we were both absolutely so thrilled because we had spent years finding clay pipe stems and not the bowls. And bear in mind, in the part of London where I grew up, it was the suburbs, and so there wasn't so much to be found as when you look centrally. So it, you know, it was, things were hard won. So you know, one particular pipe bowl has particular meaning for me, that one.
That's lovely.
Yeah.
Very stuff personal. Like that. Anything else?
Things that I found with my daughter, or she has found, are really precious. So she found a very giant garnet when she was about three, and she was with myself and my partner. So we were all three of us together, and actually I should give him a shout out because he created my Instagram for me in 2016, because he was like, I want you to find your people, like find people who are interested in mudlarking. Because
so
it was very sweet, because I think he was fed up with me bringing stuff home and showing him, and he was really very bored to tears by it. So but he's been very supportive. Yeah. So
there we go. Lovely.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, that's lovely. I'm going to turn that off now, if that's okay.
Yeah.